Okay, a little closer. First, I'd like to acknowledge some individuals who are in attendance today. The Honorable Judge Ronald Ibarra, Chief Judge of the Third Circuit. The Honorable Judge Elizabeth Strance of the Third Circuit. Honorable Judge Ali Auna, Third Circuit Family Judge Court. Court Judge, excuse me. Lester Ashiro, Chief Court Administrator for the Third Circuit. Don West, Deputy Chief Court Administrator. Wes Sua, Deputy Chief Court Administrator. Calvin Young, President of the Hawaii State Bar Association. Greg Markham, President-elect of the Hawaii State Bar Association. Barbara Dalton, Governor's Liaison for West Hawaii. Jay Yoshimoto, County Council Chair, Hawaii County Council Chair. Karen Eoff, County Councilwoman. Drew Kanuha, County Councilman. Miley David, Clerk of the Hawaii County Council. Mitch Roth, Hawaii County Prosecutor. And Peter Bresciani, Supervising Attorney of the Public Defender's Office of Kona. Thank you for coming. Okay, so I think I speak for everyone that we're very excited to have the Supreme Court here. But I want to remind everyone that this is an official proceeding of the Supreme Court, so we're going to ask you to conduct yourself as if you were in the courtroom of the Supreme Court. And that means please check your cell phone right now, make sure it's turned off. No talking during the arguments. No cheering, no clapping, no applause. Any form of noise that you can make, please refrain. And again, no photography or filming unless you have special permission. Following the arguments, the students will stay here in the gymnasium. The public and the non-volunteer attorneys will be asked to leave, to exit. And finally, a reminder that you're going to be asked to stand when the justices enter the room, which is going to happen very soon. Thank you so much.
Good morning and aloha, everyone. The court is honored to be here today at Kealakehi High School as part of our Courts in the Community program. Counsel, are you ready to proceed this morning?
Yes.
Okay, very well. Mr. Esser, my understanding is you've asked to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, so a warning light will come on when you have 10 minutes to go in your argument, and Ms. Martin will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. Thank you very much. Mr. Esser, please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Peter Van Name Esser. I represent Jeffrey.
You may want to pull the mic up a little bit higher. There you go.
My name is Peter Van Name Esser, and I represent Jeffrey Malfino, who is the petitioner and the plaintiff and the appellant in this case. This is a case about mistakes that were made by the Hawaii County Planning Department in 2004 and 2005. Mistakes that aren't disputed, they've been acknowledged by the department. The question before this court, and it's a very narrow one, and not involving records across the state, but records in this particular department. The question is quoted in the court's description of this argument today, and it's also the first sentence in my cert petition. The policy question before this court is whether the Hawaii County Planning Department, which issues critical rulings regarding subdivisions on Big Island property and maintains permanent subdivision records for its own purposes and public access, has a duty to exercise reasonable care in the maintenance of existing subdivision records. What this case is not about is flawless county files, is perfect records, is absolutely and completely correct information or maintaining its records with unerring accuracy, which are statements that have been made by the county and the ICA and the judge who ruled below.
Mr. Esser, that does seem to be your position, that you are arguing that the records have to be maintained perfectly.
I never use the word perfectly, and what I'm saying is that the county has an obligation to exercise reasonable care. That's all I've ever argued. That's what the cases call for. Reasonable care does not necessarily mean perfect records.
Well, what evidence is there that there wasn't reasonable care?
One of the pieces of evidence is that there was no investigation to find out why the files disappeared. To me, that's evidence of negligence. If I was running a planning department and I wanted to find, and something like this happened, and a multi-million-dollar property was issued, two wrong subdivision rulings, I would want to know what happened to those files. And when he was asked, when Christopher Ewan was asked during his deposition, if he investigated what happened to the files, he said no. In terms of the record, there's plenty of evidence here that there was a mistake. Whether it was based on negligence is a question for the jury to decide. There is evidence of negligence. And the word perfect has not been used.
Well, you've used the word existing, maintain existing records. It seems to be your fundamental premise that unless it's retained, the records are maintained perfectly, it seems as if that's your position.
No, my position is that the county has to exercise a duty of care, and that would depend on how they are checked out, where they are stored, whether this has ever happened before. There is evidence in this record to support negligence, Your Honor, and therefore summary judgment's inappropriate on that grounds. The point is we are not taking the position, which has been alleged by the county, that there have to be flawless records. And I continue to state that position. The question is whether there is any duty at all. If you look at Judge Nakamura's ruling and the ICA, respectfully, Justice Pollack, what they are saying is there's no duty whatsoever. They are not saying that there's no duty to keep flawless records. They're saying that there's no duty whatsoever.
Now, the duty that you're arguing for, it's not a common law duty, correct? It's based on statutes, rules, or ordinances?
We are arguing it as based on statute, and that's, of course, how you approach this under the Coody case. But there is a common law cause of action for negligent misrepresentation. And you can't really look at the records issue in this case without also going to the significance of the missing records.
But there was no misrepresentation, though. In other words, there was an absence of a record, but not an affirmative misrepresentation. So the common law theory of negligent misrepresentation wouldn't appear to apply.
Respectfully, Your Honor, there's two connected pieces of negligence alleged in this complaint. And the misrepresentation is that only two lots existed on this 48-acre property. That clearly is a negligent misrepresentation, and it was caused.
Well, isn't that based on the June 2004 letter? I thought that your client had waived any independent claims based on that letter.
No, my client has not waived any independent claims based on that letter. In fact, specifically, Your Honor, the trial judge did not ever rule on that issue. The only thing he waived, I assume you're talking about coming from federal court back to state court. The only things he waived were due process and federal constitutional arguments. He most definitely did not waive the issue of the June 2nd, 2004 letter. And respectfully, Justice Rechtenwald, you have to look at the significance of the missing records. You can't just look at them, you can't just say they're missing. There is the significance that when my client looked at the records before buying the house and before accepting an offer, that the fact that it wasn't there influenced him. But obviously, the negligent misrepresentation, either under common law or under the restatement, which this court asked us to comment about, was when there was a statement which has been acknowledged as a mistake by the department that only two lots could be on this property. That statement was based in part on negligence.
Mr. Esser, didn't you say to Judge Seabright, I'm saying that my client waived any rights he would have had to challenge that determination?
No, I do not know about any such statement. And in fact, there's a statement in a footnote in the opening brief which quotes Judge Seabright. right, in the context of the issue of exhausting administrative remedies, where he says, I don't know what else the defendant could have done. The two issues, Justice Nakayama, that were raised in the initial motion for partial summary judgment as to count five, which was the negligence count, was whether or not there was a failure to waive administrative remedies, and also whether or not there was no causation because of the fact that the property, he'd already signed, quote unquote, binding, accepted an offer on the property.
Right.
And
so
the judge specifically denied that motion. And when he ruled later on the final motion, all he addressed was the duty. He did not address the issue at all. There's been no waiver.
How can there be a claim based on a letter when your client agreed to sell the lot even before he heard from the letter?
Well, what he did is accept an offer, and whether or not, and he did that on the
basis.
And
the buyer said he would not have allowed your client to get out of it.
Well, that's a question of fact, and that's not a summary judgment issue, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this. When do you say that this negligent act actually occurred?
I think it occurred in several places, and it could be that it started as long as 3 years prior to this event, when the original Williams Goldstein correspondence was misplaced. You've also
let me ask you this: if it occurred 3 years, maybe obviously before your client purchased the property, then if we assume that's when the error occurred, if it had been there, how can we assume your client would have purchased the property? The person, the seller, may never have sold you the property. And the property would have been sold for much, much more than what your client purchased it for.
Well, that's an interesting.
Did the trial court ever reach any issue of causation or damages? It was. Based on a duty argument.
You're answering
correct?
For me. The problem with that discussion and that speculation is that it's not part of any of the rulings so far in this case. It's not part of the six-page SDO. It's not part of the Wade Nakamura rule. The only thing before this court in terms of rulings is that. Now, I understand that if there are the six other grounds argued by the other side, you could affirm the summary judgment. I understand that.
It all goes to causation, and that's part of it. Under your theory, if it existed for 3 years and every single buyer, potential buyer who looked at this lot, every person before who ever took a look and had any interest in the property is a potential plaintiff.
Respectfully, causation is not before this court, except as an alternative argument. And as we argued in our briefs, causation is a uniquely factual discussion. There's no evidence in front of this court that those files were missing until my client looked for them in 2003. I don't know when they went missing. And I also don't know when the specific negligence occurred. And part of the difficulty we have is that by finding there's no duty whatsoever to maintain records and not making any other ruling in either the ICA or by the trial court, we don't have a record in front of this court that's sufficient for this court to even rule.
Mr. Esser, could you?
Excuse me, I don't want to cut off Justice Pollack because I think it's a good question. And I want to make clear, I understand that I'm in front of this court with a whole bunch of other arguments involving things that don't involve the negligence issues. The duty to maintain records and the duty to recognize prior subdivisions. I understand that. I only say that to the extent that I look at this record that we have right now, that the primary issue is the mixture of those two counts. And I just point out to you, Mr. Chief Justice, that if you look at count five, it clearly covers both the issue of negligent record keeping and a negligent misrepresentation about the number of lots. Indeed, that's what caused the damage, not the missing records.
Well, the complaint actually sounds like a negligent decision as opposed to a negligent representation. The theory of representation, according to the defense, evolved during the course of the case. But the complaint itself appears to be pled more along the lines of there was a negligent decision made by Mr. Ewan based on the inaccurate records. Is that a theory you're still pursuing or not?
Yes, we are, and I agree with Your Honor, which is why in my most recent brief I cited the Kahala case. And the Kahala case essentially took a brief where negligent misrepresentation wasn't alleged and said it's there. I think the elements are there. I acknowledge completely that the words negligent misrepresentation are not in the brief. Now, it is true that the county has this theory that somehow when the complaint was drafted that there was no complaint about negligent record keeping. That's simply untrue. I mean, all you have to do is look in count five. It's right there.
And coming back to the issue of duty, you know, and focusing particularly on your argument that there are statutes, rules, and ordinances that provide a basis for the duty, don't all of those statutes that you cite or rules that you cite talk about providing access to records rather than imposing a duty to maintain them? And how do you get from a duty to provide access to the public to records to a duty to maintain them in a certain manner?
Well, again, I'm starting with the CUDI definition of how you define a public duty when you're talking about a public entity. And to me, what we have to look at is the statutory duty of the Department of Planning. And to me, if you look at Chapter 92 and Chapter 92F, and you look at their own rules, especially 1.8, you ask yourself the very logical question, what good is access if the files are incomplete? In other words, access only makes sense if they're complete.
That's not, 92F has specific remedies that it provides if access isn't provided. So I don't think I agree with that position where you say, what good is access if there isn't some sort of remedy for the 92F says, look, you can go in there for judicial enforcement. It has specific remedies. It has remedies for criminal penalties. So if you're going by that statutory duty and you're gonna rely on it, then I think you're subject to their penalties that are provided. You can't make up your own penalties and use the statute that creates the duty.
Well, respectfully, Hawaii has never taken the position that you have to have a specific cause of action in a statute in order to establish a duty. That's the whole point of the CUDI case. That's actually how the Oregon Supreme Court is ruling. The Oregon Supreme Court saying that unless it's obvious from the statute that they're creating some kind of tort liability, that they're not gonna recognize it. That is the position the state's never taken. I would cite, Your Honor, to 92F-2, which clearly says that part of the purpose of the act is to assure the maintenance of accurate records. It's right there. I'd also refer you to 92F-27, which provides for a general cause of action against the county and county individuals named in their official capacity, which, by the way, 92F-6.
Actually, that 92F-27 pertains to Part 3, remedies under Part 3, which is failure to provide or access to disclosure of personal records. An individual's personal records. It does not apply to this situation.
I understand that, Your
and
Honor.
And 92F2 talks about government agencies exist to aid the people in the formation and conduct of public policy. That's what 92F is for. It's not for creating remedies for people when an agency may make a mistake.
I would argue, starting with 1.8, which the ICA indicated is similar, is a sort of county application of UIPA, and 92F, and 92, and 46, the county administration laws, that if you look everywhere, it says the county is obligated to take steps to keep accurate records. That is throughout these laws. It doesn't just say you provide access. You're supposed to come up with annual plans to tell them what you're doing to preserve those records.
And this is what Mr. Ewan said in his deposition. He says there's a written policy in his department to keep something like this. All correspondence that pertains to a particular property is kept in the intended file. There's an overall county policy to retain these documents. If you want to sign out for them, you have to sign out. It sounds like to me they have policies and procedures that they follow.
Thank you for bringing it back to Mr. Ewan, who in a very honest, straightforward way answered questions in his deposition without his lawyer telling him to be quiet because otherwise he'd sabotage the county's case. I absolutely agree with you, Your Honor. He states over and over again that there is an obligation, a public policy to maintain those records. He says it. He says existing records. Take the Nu'uanu and the Shopu cases, which are relied upon by the county constantly and also I think by the ICA. Those cases say if you have existing records, you are obligated to provide access to them.
Let me ask you this. You are now referring to 92F.
Yes.
Is there a common law duty to provide access to government records?
I do not believe so.
Okay, so if we are under 92F then, you do agree that 92F-16's immunity provision for good faith failure to provide access would apply, is that correct?
I do not.
Then why wouldn't it apply? 92F-16 says immunity from liability,
anyone participating
in good faith.
Yes. What it does is it says for either disclosing or refusing to disclose, neither of which applies in this case. But more importantly, if you look at the citation under that to the opinion of the Information Practices, Office of Information Practices, this is number 91-20, 1991, it clearly says that this does not apply to officers who are sued in their individual capacity or the county. We sued you in his individual capacity.
Did you allege malice or other improper purpose as required under Towsie versus
All right,
State
that's a whole
other Madero's
argument, and I'm happy to address it. But just focusing for a minute on this last-minute statute that was thrown at me in the supplemental brief, and by the way, wasn't argued below, wasn't argued in the ICA, and wasn't argued in response to my cert petition.
Mr. Esser.
Suddenly, this is coming up as some kind of new big deal. It doesn't even apply to the defendants in this case. That's my position.
In terms of personal liability, obviously, in terms of the county, in terms of malice, that only applies to a personal liability of a government official.
Okay, you're talking
about the county is still
I understand.
Be held liable for negligence.
Qualified immunity, Towse, Runnels, all those cases. Again, the general law, Your Honor, is that those decisions are not made on the basis of summary judgment rulings. They're based on facts. The question of whether there was malice or reckless disregard or whatever, that is not in front of this court, except as a secondary reason to affirm.
Actually, and those cases also hold that you have to allege and prove malice or other improper purpose. I don't see any allegation of malice in this complaint as to Mr. Ewan in his individual capacity.
Okay.
Or any evidence in the record showing any act equivalent or even coming close to malice.
I disagree with that. If you look at the definition of malice in Towse, it clearly is broad enough to include situations where there's no malice. I would take the position that that issue has not been litigated. It was simply raised as an alternative grounds that the argument in front of this court, whether you want to decide it or not, is whether or not there's a duty, and this duty extends beyond records, which there is no common law duty to take care of, to issuing a decision that is a negligent misrepresentation that damages someone. Now, there's also a debate, which to a certain extent, Justice Pollack's gotten into.
Can you respond to, again? Chief Justice asked you about where is the misrepresentation, and you just referred to
the
it
the misrepresentation
again.
Is the June 2nd, 2004 letter. That's a misrepresentation. It says there's only two lots. There's six. That's pretty clear.
But that occurs after the property is sold.
No, it doesn't. It occurs before it is transferred while there's an offer pending, which is a matter of fact. That is not before this court. There is insufficient evidence to take that position. The county will argue otherwise, but causation was not ruled upon by Nakamura or the ICA. And whether or not there was causation, the Pickering case says, is a question of fact. What facts are in front of this court on whether or not that was a valid contract? None. There's only a deposition of my client where they ask him, you know, could you have gotten out of the deal? That's not sufficient for summary judgment on causation. So I understand that there's difficulties in terms of the timing of these events, but there's no question that the June 2nd, 2004 letter is a negligent misrepresentation. You know that, Justice Pollack, in your decision you just issued in Kelberg, where you cite in two places that you acknowledge making mistakes when he issued that letter. Now, the difference between a mistake and negligence is not so far. So we have an admission that a mistake was made. And whether or not there was causation is not before this court, and there is not a sufficient record to rule on it. And again, Pickering says it's a question of fact. I understand, Justice McKenna, that the liability of a state or county employee under Towse and Runnels and that line of cases, all of which are ancient, is a question of concern to this court. My understanding is that record is not sufficiently solid at this point to make a ruling on that. Nevertheless,
well, actually, the county cites it for the wrong proposition. They seem to be arguing that because there's no showing of malice and because Mr. Ewan cannot be held liable, therefore the county cannot be held liable. The issue in those cases is for there to be personal liability of a county or government official, you have to allege and prove malice or other improper purpose. The negligence standard applies to vicarious liability of the county.
Perhaps I should have argued that in my reply brief, Your Honor. I apologize for leaving that out.
Mr. Esser, you're into your rebuttal time. Do you wish to reserve that time now, or did you have any points you wanted to make?
Just
before
one other point. I am concerned about the rhetoric in this case. I am partly concerned because Justice Pollack's concerned about this idea of perfect records. That's not what we're claiming. That word doesn't exist in my pleadings and doesn't below. And I also object to the language that is repeated constantly about impossible burden, unlimited liability, risk millions of taxpayer monies, unmanageable. In the 40 years since the restatement came down, there has not been a single case addressing 52-3 or rejecting it. To say somehow that if you let this one little case go to a jury, that somehow the sky's gonna fall, to me is hyperbole. And I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Esser. Ms. Martin, your argument.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Laureen Martin on behalf of the County of Hawaii and Christopher Ewan. I know the court had a question on whether Mr. Molfino had waived his rights in front of Judge Seabright. And if you refer to the record on appeal, page 312, his attorney at the time, who was not Mr. Esser, it was another attorney, stated, "I'm saying that my client waived any rights he would have had to challenge that determination." Also at that hearing, if you look at the previous page, record on appeal 311, the court asked, "In other words, you're not saying the county was necessarily wrong, but for the fact that there, that letter in the file." And the attorney states that's correct. Mr. Molfino seeks to hold the county liable for the absence of information.
Ms. Martin, I want to ask you a question.
Yes.
What can you address Mr. Esser's argument that the county's liable because, or one of the some evidence of the county's negligence is the failure to conduct an investigation as to why the letter went missing?
Yeah, that's clearly after the fact. It does not indicate, could not have caused any damages to the plaintiff at all. And the county does not have any obligation to go around and conduct an investigation if the director felt that that would not serve a legitimate purpose. It doesn't make sense for the county to spend a lot of time asking, when was the last time you saw the letter? Did you see the letter? When did the last time you see the letter? Mr. The director, Christopher Ewan, is in control of his department. He knows his personnel. And simply because a formal investigation was not conducted is not a basis to infer negligence, which could have caused damage to the plaintiff.
Does that argument lay open the possibility if you had conducted investigation, then the complaint might be how many people were part of the panel that conducted the investigation, how long the investigation was, how many people they subpoenaed, or how extensive were the findings? Is that kind of a slippery slope?
It certainly is, and certainly as the arguments with the plaintiff has evolved over time, certainly if Mr. Ewan had stated, well, we did an investigation, or I asked certain people about it, certainly the plaintiff could come in and say, well, that's an inadequate investigation.
Is it the county's position that the county has no obligation to maintain government records which it has chosen to possess and retain?
The question before this court isn't whether the government should keep accurate and complete records. We all should strive to do that, everyone, whether it's the government or—
Isn't that what the trial judge ruled, that there really was no duty to keep government records?
Yes, and that's exactly what I'm getting to. Do you have a duty in the sense of is it a good thing to strive for? It's do you have a legal duty that will result in liability when the inevitable happens, because no one keeps
their
records.
That's not what the trial judge ruled. The trial judge ruled that there was no duty for the government to maintain government records.
Right, a legal
duty. Is
that
a policy that is good for the community?
Yes, it definitely is.
It's good for the community for the government to have no obligation to maintain government records that the community may be relying on?
Yes, again, this is a legal duty that we're talking about that can expose the government to liability and damages.
What if the records involved related to a possible threat to health and safety of the public? In that instance, even though maintaining a record that perhaps said something about a floodplain or a possible prior disciplinary record of an applicant for a position, as a result of that record not being there, someone acted not in reliance on it, and there was a harm to the health or safety of a citizen. Is that, there's no duty even in that case, for example, failing to maintain a record that would show that a particular house was located in a floodplain?
Yes, it's the same. I don't think you can pick and choose, and this would open up the door of liability if you start saying,
but wait a minute, doesn't 92F6, Chapter 92F, hasn't the legislature said that it's important for government records to be open and accessible to the public? And hasn't the legislature addressed the concern of the county here through passing 92F-16 regarding immunity from liability, which says that if someone is participating in good faith, in other words, if you are in good faith trying to allow access to records, there's no criminal or civil liability. Isn't that the proper balance to be drawn? Hasn't the legislature drawn that balance?
I think that's a good argument, and that's one of the points.
So
that
then won't
made.
We recognize an actual duty, and then wouldn't it be a factual issue for which summary judgment would not have been proper in this situation?
No. If for this court to impose the liability in this case, it would ignore its own case law.
We are not imposing liability here. The only issue before this court is whether or not the government has a duty to maintain records that are supposed to be in its files.
Well, however you phrase it, if you say it's a duty or liability, this court would still be ignoring
no,
its case
No, duty
law.
Is separate. For any negligence claim, there's not only a duty, there has to be a breach of that duty, there has to be causation, and there has to be proof of damages also.
I understand that.
But we never reached those issues in this case.
I understand that, but SHOPO and New Uano Valley both spoke to the duty.
Right. They said, let's see, was it Nuanu, that it wasn't a government record, therefore there was no duty to maintain. It wasn't an actual government record. There's no dispute in this case that the letters were government records, correct?
No, we're not disputing that.
Okay.
Ms. Martin, I'd like to follow up two parts. First, as I understand you, it seems what you're saying, following up with the Chief Justice question was, you seem to be saying that if the agency wanted to, as every record comes in, they could just throw it over their head and just let it pile as high as they wanted and not do anything. That seems to be your argument. And the other thing I want to ask you, at the same token, it seems to me this issue in some ways has already been decided by Cootie, which everybody seems to be relying on the first half of the case, which says the agency was not required to do an engineering study. But what Cootie also says very specifically, we hold that the procedures used by the county in granting the approval for the subdivision were reasonable. We further hold there was no breach of any duty of care by the county in the application process utilized by the agency. Cootie seems to require that the procedures that are employed for maintaining the records there's a reasonable duty of care. It doesn't go to maintaining perfect records, but I'm talking about the procedures that are employed. This case seems to require it. It talks about it in two different areas. And what would be wrong with the county having to undertake, as Mr. Ewan said, we take the records, we keep them, we have a filing system, we put in the tax map key file, anybody who wants to sign out. Why hasn't the agency complied with its reasonable duty to maintain proper procedures for retaining records?
We have reasonable procedures in place.
But in response to two of my colleagues, you said you had no duty, and it seems to me there is a duty to employ procedures.
What are your procedures? Because, 92F18 does require each agency, including the county, to issue guidelines necessary to effectuate that chapter. So what is there other than Section 1.8 of the Planning Commission, the code?
Well, Mr. Ewan had testified that there is that checkout procedure, but I believe that Chapter 92F says that the agency may. I don't believe it's a shall.
It says shall.
Oh.
Ms. Martin.
Corrected.
The chapter 92, one of the big arguments you make in your response to the application for cert is that they never, the other side never argued chapter 92 below as a basis for the duty. And it seems that that's what they're hinging the duty on before this court is under chapter 92.
Right.
So are you still relying on waiver? Is that one of your?
The complaint actually alleges statutory duties, and when you filed your motion for summary judgment, you referred to Chapter 92F, correct?
I believe I did in a footnote.
In a footnote.
What about the issue of causation? You heard Justice Pollack ask Mr. Esser about whether the issue of causation is something that this court could or should reach. If I understood Mr. Esser's response, it's that we don't know that there was a binding contract or the record's inadequate to enable us to find that there was a binding contract to sell this property in place prior to any representation coming from Mr. Ewan. Would you agree that there is or is not a record that we could resolve that issue on?
There definitely is a record. Contract is part of the record, and I apologize, I don't have the site for that, but it is part of the record. The plaintiff also admitted in a set of admissions at Record on Appeal 759, number 58, admit that on February 5th, 2004, when you accepted the offer by Michael Pruglo, you were contractually obligated to sell the property. So it's not that he ever questioned that that contract was invalid in some way.
He admitted that he was contractually obligated to sell.
Yes, and again on Record on Appeal 758, Admission 53, which is a similar language.
So that admission wasn't contingent in any way on a determination of the lawfulness of the contract or enforceability
He never argued that that contract was invalid in any way. He did make an argument, the counsel made an argument, that he might have been able to get out of the contract based upon a mutual mistake. But there's no evidence that it was a mutual mistake because we have the letter from Mr. Molfino requesting the seven lots, the seven pre-existing lots, so he clearly believed he was entitled to seven lots, and Mr. Pruglo also believed that. So they both were under that impression. There's no mutual mistake.
Did the trial court rule on that issue, however?
No.
The trial court actually never addressed causation, correct?
That's correct.
What was the status of discovery? Where were we procedurally in this case? Had the trial date been set? Had discovery been cut off?
I believe that it was at the very end. We were getting ready for trial. I remember that. I don't remember the exact deadlines, but we were at the end.
Had all the discovery been completed?
That's my understanding, yes, because we had deposed experts, so we were ready to go.
When Mr. Ewan, as part of his deposition, stated that according to 1.8, the county is obligated to take steps to ensure accurate records. Is he giving up the ship?
No, I don't believe so. I think he's looking at it, again, from a practical standpoint. He, as a director, how he wants to see his department run. He's not saying from a legal standpoint what's required. He's not the court. He's not the one who's going to make these kind of legal rulings that are going to be binding upon the court or the county. He's just speaking from a practical standpoint.
Mr. Esser is arguing today that he has not been advocating a perfect record system. What's your take on that?
I think this case is very clear, and this slide represents the planning file that Mr. Molfino looked at. So he says that there are documents in there, and what he chose to rely on is this. The lack of information. That's what he zeroes in on. He doesn't rely on the other documents. He doesn't rely upon the county code regarding subdivisions. He says, oh, look there. I only can get two lots.
But well, don't your rules allow people to request information regarding pre-existing lots? Isn't that specifically called for?
I think you're referring to a rule which Mr. Esser had cited to, and it does not deal with pre-existing lots. But they can make a request. The burden under the county code is for them to bring forward this evidence. He could have gotten this evidence or this letter from the seller. The seller probably should have provided it under, I believe it's chapter 58D, but he chose to rely on this. That's clearly not reasonable. That's why they are requiring us to be perfect, because even the absence of a letter can impose liability.
Criteria to determine a pre-existing lot. The director shall certify that a lot is pre-existing if these following criteria are met. Owner of property, okay, seeking certification as a pre-existing lot shall provide reasonable evidence to meet the criteria set forth herein. All right, so they did not have the evidence for that. However, that evidence should have been in the file.
Yes, I believe that that's accurate. Part of the, and I realize Mr. Esser saying, we're not asking them to be perfect. We're asking them to take reasonable measures. But really what they're trying to impose is strict liability. They're saying, look, you were supposed to have that letter in there by your own policies, and it's not there. So now you're liable. But well, but that doesn't mean we're negligent. For all we know, for all the evidence, it's...
We never reached the issue of whether or not there was negligence, correct? Because the judge basically said there's no duty. There's no duty.
I understand
that. That's just the first prong.
I understand that that's what the rulings have been in the past. But this court has stated summary judgment must be affirmed if correct, even if the lower court gave a wrong reason.
So and which alternative basis are you arguing?
I'm arguing no negligence, no causation.
Well, wait a minute. No negligence meaning no duty or no breach of duty?
Both. There's no duty. There's no breach of the duty. There's no evidence of it at all. What we have is this file with a missing letter. And suddenly that's supposed to be enough to impose liability. For all we know, Mr. Molfino could have taken the letter out of that file. Or his neighbor could have taken it.
This summary judgment, you have to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, correct? And so whether or not there was a breach of the duty would usually be a question of fact for which summary judgment would not be appropriate, correct? The only way that this decision could be affirmed would be if this court held that there was no duty or there was no causation as a matter of law.
I understand your point, but I don't agree with it. Because even though you're required to take the inferences most favorable to the plaintiff, he has to have some evidence. And the standard is, can a reasonable jury find? And a reasonable jury couldn't find negligence in this case because there's no evidence of it.
Well, couldn't a reasonable jury wonder why a letter or several documents that pertain to six pre-existing lots wasn't there for several years, suddenly reappears?
Definitely. A jury could wonder, but that's not negligence. We can all wonder, but that's just speculation.
Ms. Martin, it seems to me as I read through what has been argued by the petitioner is that they actually seem, they are arguing that there is, I hear the argument today, but the argument seems to be when I look at the opening brief, it says, has a duty to maintain existing records in an accurate, timely, relevant, and complete manner. The duty being any existing record has to be there. And it's repeated again and again. At page 16 of the app, regardless of the issue argued below on appeal, is that the planning department has a duty to maintain existing subdivision records. It keeps going back that the duty is not the procedure on how you keep the records, but a duty to maintain all existing records, which seems to me the duty that they are asking this court to uphold is perfection.
I agree with that. You know, and part of it, this whole record retention policy, it really is not for the court to decide. That really is an executive function to decide what records should be kept. There's no authority for the court to impose that upon a separate branch of government.
Ms. Martin.
I'm assuming these records are just kind of kept, as things come in, they're placed in the file. There's no, for example, in our courts, we have a computerized docket. In other words, every document that comes in, you can go online and see you know, the complaint was filed on such and such date, the answer was filed on such and such date. There's a docket, there's a listing, an index of all the documents. Are you saying that the county, it would be too much for the county to have that type of procedure?
I believe so, and part of it is, if you required that, you were now running the executive branch. You were telling the executive how best to do their job. And the executive should be free to allocate funds to where they want. And I'll give you an example in this case. Mr. Molfino, one of his complaints was, it took 5 months for this decision. So are we gonna take resources, which are obviously precious to the government?
What did the discovery show in terms of what the record-keeping policies were? What did the policy show as to, what did the discovery show as to, like if somebody wants to go in and look at a file, you know, like, can they, where do they actually look at it? Where, can they take it out of the sight of a government employee?
I don't believe that's in the record.
That's not in the record?
I don't believe it is.
Doesn't that raise questions of fact as to negligence? Negligence
no.
of maintaining the records?
No, I don't believe so at all.
Mr. Ewan say the document can be checked out and copied by the public, it's not supposed to leave the office?
That is correct.
Let me ask you this, there's been an argument from the other side that says, look, the sky isn't falling, this is the only case. But isn't that some indication, if it's the only case, that maybe the procedures that have been being used may have some accomplishing their objective?
Right. The sky isn't falling, except the county is going to risk $2.2 million of taxpayer money on one case, because Mr. Molfino relied upon that.
But can't every potential buyer who says that they looked at the record, people before, after, I mean, it seems to me...
will now have a cause of action against the county. Even the neighbor can say, I looked at that file and I didn't see the pre-existing lot determination, so I bought it because I thought you couldn't subdivide it. It's a very broad liability.
And this is despite listing the property for sale 1 month after he purchased it.
For more than twice what he paid. And I do want to point out, when he entered into that binding contract to sell the property, he knew he hadn't gotten a determination on the 7 lots. So he chose not to wait for that. He quickly accepted that offer, which obviously is wise when you're more than doubling your money.
Well, did the discovery show why he went in for a pre-existing lot determination in the first place? Why did he choose seven? Where did he get that?
Actually, I think this is the next slide. So this is his request. I believe he is saying that it's based upon five houses and then two 20-acre parcels.
There's actually five houses already there.
Yes.
So he thought that there must have been pre-existing lots for those five houses.
That's what his argument was.
You know, under 23.119, it says, shall provide reasonable evidence. So what reasonable evidence do we have besides this letter?
In this particular letter, he also refers to the grants. He had submitted some land grants, apparently.
He didn't attach a map to that, did he?
No, not,
And the prior person who got the approval did attach a map showing where the lots were.
Exactly.
Did this application conform to 23-119?
I think it's consistent. I believe that's how they do those pre-existing lot determinations. It's just merely a letter. It's just a correspondence file. I did want to clear up, this is not a subdivision record. Subdivision records are much more formal. There's provisions for it to be recorded. There's much more legal significance to it. This is merely a correspondence file.
Can we come back to the issue of causation, because it really is sort of focusing on the question of whether, based on the absence, it can be said that given the, in view of the absence of this record, nevertheless, Mr. Molfino went ahead and purchased or entered into the contract to sell this property. Again, your position is that we can resolve as a matter of law that there were no legal grounds under which he could have avoided that contract, such as mistake of fact?
Yes, I believe so. You know, one of the issues, and I understand you're obligated to take inferences in the plaintiff's favor, but you're not required to abandon your common sense. You have the letter. The undisputed facts show he purchased the property, immediately put it up for sale. He submits the request for 7 pre-existing lots, and then he enters into this binding contract by his own choice without knowing that he would have, whether he would have 7 pre-existing lots or not. That's 4 months prior to Mr. Ewan's decision. Clear-cut case of no causation. It doesn't really matter if he says, well, I would have tried to get out of it, or, you know, and Mr. Pulugo is very clear, he wouldn't have let him out of it. But he can't just speculate and make these things up with wishful thinking. He needs to have enough evidence to convince a reasonable jury, and he doesn't.
Why did the trial court not grant summary judgment on this basis? Was that articulated by the court? And is it problematic for us to go ahead and rely on that in view of its passing on that issue?
I think the court, which generally I think is not that uncommon in the Third Circuit at least, is that they'll pick out one argument that they find most compelling. But I don't think it's problematic for this court to rule on any other issue. And even if it doesn't want to address the public duty issue, I think it's acceptable for it to address a separate issue. The case law clearly says that. It would be an appropriate thing to do. This case has been pending for several years. And if this court is only going to rule on one piece and then send it back for another determination, and then it may come back again, it's just not an efficient use of the court's time. And it's not beneficial for the parties either.
Do you feel there's a proximate cause issue as well? I mean, that he's within this class of people that should be protected.
I don't think he should be, that he is in this class that should be protected. And part of the reason I feel that is the government, including with this open records legal requirement, the government is in this position of having to do certain things that no one else needs to do. No private business, no private individual is obligated to do these public functions, including open their records, issuing building permits, making these judgment calls that the legislative branch has designated the planning director to make. And so it really is this public duty that only the government can have. And so if you're imposing liability on the government, you really are singling out the government, because nobody else will have that kind of liability. And it's for this public good that we're doing it. It's not for any profit for ourselves. It's for the public good that we need to do these things. And if you're imposing liability, what you're going to do is increase the cost of government. And it's not a benefit to the public or the taxpayers, because we have to do these things. We know we're not going to be perfect at it. There are other remedies, such as an administrative appeal that they could take. It's certainly subject to circuit court review and this court's review if there's a case that
somebody
wants to challenge.
Doesn't 92F16 suggest that the legislature intends to impose on the government at least a good faith duty to maintain its records?
No, I don't see that at all, because that's just the immunity provision. I think what they were concerned with was if somebody was malicious and they wanted to hurt
right.
somebody else.
So it seems that the legislature is saying, you know, perhaps standard negligence is not enough for there to be liability, as long as the access or the it was in good faith, there can be no liability. But if government officials maliciously, as you say, decide to hide documents or you know, something of that nature because they don't like somebody, or they actually want their friend to see that, you know, there's a potential of making money, that type of thing, then there will be liability. There can be liability. But if it's in good faith, there isn't.
Well, I think that's accurate, an accurate statement of what that provision.
Isn't that a good balance? I mean, shouldn't the government have some duty to maintain records?
Well, what I was saying is that I think the way you described it is there's some liability if you're malicious, I think is accurate. But I'm not saying it's the duty to maintain. It's the actual act of here's the records and we did something wrong. We were malicious about disclosure or not disclosure. That provision does not deal with
maintaining records.
Well,
what if, you know,
records.
I mean, duty to maintain. Would it be good faith to allow people to come in, take the file and take it home and then bring it back? Do you think that would be good faith?
Yeah. That's not malicious. That might be a bad idea, but that's not malicious.
Okay.
Any other questions?
So then the government would be able to pick and choose who they would allow, because some people they might not trust, some people they might trust.
That may be true, you know, and there may be a legitimate reason for doing that. But that would be an executive branch decision. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Martin. We'll hear now Mr. Esser's rebuttal. There's 8 minutes left for Mr. Esser.
Oh, you covered a lot of subjects. First of all, the county referred to that December 24th, 2003 letter where Mr. Mofino requested a lot determination. He also, down towards the bottom of that letter, said, we would like to consolidate and resubdivide. Frequently, it's a two-step process. First, you locate the lots, and then you consolidate and resubdivide. In this case, he tried to do both at the same
time. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry.
Consolidate and reset the...
Frequently, what you do is you locate the lots, and then you file a request for consolidation and resubdivision.
Oh, resubdivision.
It's a two-step process. In this case, he was requesting it in the same letter. He was doing it on the basis of five houses on five lots with an extra lot that was not connected. In other words, six lots. And of course, whether or not this was a lot search or a subdivision request, and it sounds like it was both, there are statutes or ordinances, as you pointed out, Justice McKenna, that allow access to a person to documents that may influence the planning department's position on the subdivision or the lots. So clearly they say that it's important to them. The question of whether or not they were in fact negligent is just really not in front of this court, as Justice McKenna keeps pointing out. Whether there was causation, whether there was proximate cause, whether there was damages, you didn't bring that up, but they claim it's speculative because all damages involving subdivisions are speculative.
What about causation? So if I understand the position of the county is that there was an admission by your client that he had entered into a binding contract, and there's, in their view, nothing in the record to indicate that that contract would not have been enforced.
That's their interpretation.
Well, what's yours and what do you...
Okay.
Was there not an admission by your client that it was a binding contract?
What there was a two-page discussion about what he'd do. And it is not clear, and it's certainly not grounds for summary judgment on lack of causation. And as counsel did point out...
Actually, it's a request for admission under Rule 36. And request for admission 53, admit that on February 5, 2004, you were contractually obligated to sell the subject property to Michael Pruglo for $795,000. Admit.
Okay, is there an explanation?
No, there is no explanation.
Well, and
as there are for other requests for admissions, there is no explanation.
All right, well, that's why I refer to the court, and I can't specifically, but he was deposed and asked and discussed this for three pages. That's where she got... If there's no explanation there, that's where counsel got the idea that he thought there might be a equal mistake discussion. That came from three pages where he said, I'd have to see what I could do. Yes, he acknowledged that he accepted an offer, but it is not summary judgment that there's no causation. It's not there. And I acknowledge the importance of an admission, but the record...
It does say on February 5, 2004. It does not say... When was closing? July? He got the letter.
July.
He got the letter in June of 2004.
Yes.
Correct.
And it closed in July 19th.
And so the defense is mutual mistake.
That's what he claims he's going to try and do, and you know that depends on facts. It's also, of course, the fact that the ultimate subdivision that was allowed to Mr. Pruglow has since been stricken by the ICA. So even Mr. Pruglow doesn't have a subdivision now because they issued 7 lots instead of 6 on the basis of the description of the facts in your opinion in Kelberg, Justice Pollack. Whether or not they could establish causation is not sufficient record in front of this case. By the way, it wasn't just Nakamura that didn't address causation, it was also the ICA. If the ICA thought that there was a solid record for causation, why would they go to the difficult opinion of deciding whether or not there's a duty?
Mr. Esser, how do you address the county's contention that your previous counsel agreed that the issuance of the June 2, 2004 letter is not a separate basis for your negligence claim?
I find that completely incomprehensible. If you look at the judge's ruling on partial summary judgment, where he specifically says, I am not going to grant summary judgment on the issue involving that letter because of XYZ, that is attached as Exhibit A to my opening brief, where the judge refuses to grant summary judgment on
That was in the judge's initial summary judgment.
Yeah,
order.
That was the first one.
Right.
And clearly he would not have addressed it if there had been some kind of waiver. I know of no such waiver. I don't understand. That argument was not in the answering brief. It wasn't in the response. I don't know why it suddenly come up. I know that the judge ruled on whether or not that letter.
It's actually in the answering brief. I was quoting the answering brief.
All right. I stand corrected. But for purposes of the record, the judge received and ruled on a motion for summary judgment and turned it down as to that letter. Okay, so for purposes of causation, breach, damages, there's holes in this record. There was no trial, as Justice Rechtenwald pointed out. The facts are supposed to be interpreted in the best light for the non-moving party. In this case, the question that has come up from Nakamura and the ICA is no duty whatsoever. Again, is there a duty? I think that this case begins and ends with Ewan's deposition. He clearly thinks there was. And by the way, Justice Pollack, the reason I kept saying the word existing is because that's the only way you can bring in 92F under Nuuanu and Shopo.
Can
those
I read
cases say that you cannot require someone to maintain records. They say that, okay? Unless they're existing. What does existing mean? Existing, as according to Ewan, is we have this policy of keeping all those things. That makes them existing. That makes them come under 92F.
Can I read to you from the June 23rd, 2010, Judge Nakamura's order? This is what it says. Regarding count 5, plaintiff agrees that his claim for relief for negligence arises out of alleged failure to properly maintain the county planning department records. Defendants seek to make clear that plaintiff cannot assert a claim for negligence arising out of the issuance of the June 2, 2004 letter because the letter was not a proximate cause of plaintiff's damages. Plaintiff agrees that the issuance of the June 2, 2004 letter is not a separate basis for his negligence claim. And then it goes on and just says the letter has probative value, but its probative value has to do with your claim for the absence. So you folks agreed to it, and it's in the order.
Wow. I take the position that there's negligent misrepresentation on the basis of a failure to preserve adequate records, and that where that showed up was in the June 2, 2004 letter, which the court refused to dismiss under the partial summary judgment motion, claiming that it was a part of the claim. If you'll read the rest of what you just read, Justice Pollack, it also says, I am not going to dismiss or invalidate the June 2, 2004 ruling because it's part of the claim involving negligent records. You left that part out. So what's important is these two things are hooked together, and I think that clearly on the basis of that letter, it's a negligent misrepresentation. And my red light's on, so thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Esser. Thank you to both of our counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement, which means it will be issuing a decision at some point in the future. And at this time, on behalf of the court, I just want to express our deep appreciation for having this opportunity to come to West Hawaii and to hold oral argument in this community. And there are many people we'd like to thank and acknowledge for making this possible. But first and foremost, I'd like to thank and acknowledge the students and teachers who joined us today from Kohala High School, Kau High School, Konawaena High School, West Hawaii Explorations Academy, Makualani Christian Academy, Kealakehe High School, and Kuaokalani New Century Charter School. The students were well prepared, well dressed, respectful of the proceedings. You're absolutely fabulous representatives of your school and your community. You know, the future of our system of government depends on the public's understanding of the Constitution and the protections that it provides. And the commitment and hard work of these students and their teachers demonstrates that we're in good hands going forward. So I'd like to ask all of our other guests to acknowledge our students and teachers. We have a number of special guests here with us today, and we really appreciate their being here from the governor's office. We have Barbara Dalton from the Hawaii County Council. We have Chair Jay Yoshimoto, Council Vice Chair Karen Eoff, Council Members Valerie Poindexter and Drew Kanuha. From the Office of the Prosecuting Attorney, we have Prosecuting Attorney Mitch Roth. And from the Office of the Public Defender, we have Supervising Attorney Peter Brashani. From the Hawaii State Bar Association, we have the HSBA President Calvin Young, President-elect Greg Markham, and West Hawaii Board Member Carol Kitaoka. Also, we have here today the Hawaii Delegate to the American Bar Association, Margaret Masanaga. And again, from our Third Circuit Court, we have Chief Judge Ronald Ibarra, Judge Elizabeth Strantz, Ali Ouna, Court Administrators Lester Oshiro, Dawn West, and Wes Sua, and many other folks who've come to help us today. Could you please join me in acknowledging the court? You know, a lot of folks worked really hard to make this event happen and to transform this gymnasium into an absolutely beautiful venue for an oral argument, and I'd like to acknowledge in particular the administration and staff at Kealakehe High School. People were here working well into the evening last night to make this transformation possible. We really like to thank Principal Wilfred Murakami, Academic Advisor Alan Vogt, Jim Young, the Student Activities Coordinator, and all of the students who served as ushers and assisted in coordinating logistics of this event, as well as, again, all of our staff from the Third Circuit who helped out here today. So can you join me in everyone who helped make this work? And finally, I'd like to acknowledge the attorneys who made this educational experience, I think, so meaningful for the students. For those of you who aren't familiar with this program, a key element of the program is that prior to the oral argument taking place, the students have the opportunity to learn about the court, our role, what we're doing when we come before, when we convene court, and importantly, about the case itself, and have the opportunity to learn the issues in the case and then participate in or observe mock oral arguments involving the case. And I think that's critical in making this experience a particularly rich one from an educational point of view for the students. So the West Hawaii Bar Association has been absolutely phenomenal in volunteering their time, both inside and outside the classroom. I think there have been just wonderful stories I've heard from the members of the bar about how fulfilling they found going out to the schools and meeting with the students. And I've heard that from the teachers and students as well, that they really enjoyed and appreciated this event and all the effort that went into it. So I'd like to again extend our appreciation to the West Hawaii Bar Association, all those attorneys who volunteered, and President Robert Kim. Can you join me in giving a thanks to them? And finally, one more acknowledgement, and this is to the members of the Hawaii State Bar Association, our statewide organization of attorneys across Hawaii, and the Hawaii State Bar Foundation, which is a charitable arm of that organization. They really demonstrated a commitment to this program and a commitment to helping provide this opportunity for students through supporting and the cost of the buses to get folks to the event today, as well as lunches for all of our students who are here. We deeply appreciate their support, President Markham, President-elect Markham, and President Young. So if you can, again, please join me in acknowledging HSPA. All right, and with that, there being no further business, the court stands adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming today.